There's a story on News Nation today, and it says this is not that unusual. It's happened a few times in the last 12 months where one of the states of the, I think, 48 that participate in the Powerball didn't have their numbers in, and it's because of security protocols, whatever that means. And so this does happen sometimes. They don't announce until they know them all. But $2.04 billion is the number. Is that right? Single ticket was sold in. Oh, okay, here, this is. Wow. Pete just whispered in my ear. According to AP, just now, a single winning ticket was sold in California. One person or one ticket gets $2.04 billion.
Yeah, 3 month stretch without one. So here we go.
Say that again?
It was with 3 months since they've been doing it. So
I think they started 20 million again, which, you know, I'm not going to get out of bed for. It's 12-12. Okay. All right, John Beaver joins us now. Speaking of financial advisors, what would you tell that person, John? You're a Phase 3 Advisory Services guy over at phase3advisory.com, financial advisor. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
And what would you tell that person?
Well, what I would tell that person is make sure you sit down with a financial advisor, a lawyer, and an accountant before you say anything to anybody. That's number one.
Would you do the annuity or would you take it in a lump sum?
I would probably take the lump sum, even though the taxes are pretty egregious.
I would do the annuity only because I'm a coward. I don't want that much money at one time. And, you know, if I gave you $1 billion, you could actually, something could go wrong and you'd lose it, you'd blow it, but you can't blow money you don't have. So I always thought you'd insulate yourself over 20 or 30 years with an annuity. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think that's a great idea. And I think as a general advice, that would be a good idea. But for me, myself, I would take the lump sum up front because of all the fun things I could do with it in the stock market. Buying on midterm election day.
Yeah, okay, let's get to that. So should I buy today or should I wait tomorrow and see the results?
No, I don't think you have to wait for the results because the market rallies off of midterms just about every single time. The stats are unbelievable. But the setup to this, I have to go to the setup first. The setup is the World Series. The Phillies lost. That is really good news for the stock market. I don't know if it's some kind of a bad thing because the first stock trade took place on a street corner in Philadelphia, and it's, I don't know what it is. But as long as the Phillies don't win the World Series, the stock market is in decent shape. But yeah, midterms, what happens in midterms is that the market sells off into the midterms about a month before the midterms. Then it turns around and goes positive. It doesn't mean it's going to be positive on the year, but at least from that point, about a month before midterms, then the market starts to rally. And that's pretty consistent. You know, since 1934, we can actually take a look at this a lot of different ways. But since 1934, if we take a look at the six-month return on the stock market post-midterm, 21 out of 22 times the stock market has gained money. Even in the two-month period following, 17 out of 22 times the stock market has made money. And that average two-month return, 3.8%. So that would be on average what you'd be looking at through the end of the year. Average six-month return, 13.6%. So that's really, the odds are in your favor. Much better odds for you there than in the lottery.
Fair enough. But in those elections and in this one, it doesn't matter what party controls, say, the House, just that you get over the midterm hump, it's going to be good regardless?
That's exactly right. And it's partly the relief. And it doesn't matter if a chamber is lost either. This has been kind of interesting. So if we take a look at, back to 1856, we're looking at 40 midterm election years. 14 of those times, chamber has changed hands. And in the last 100 years, that really doesn't affect the return on that change. In fact, right now, the change of hands would be good, as Steve mentioned, because that creates gridlock for Congress, which is generally good for the stock market because the stock market doesn't like uncertainty.
This is interesting. And what do you know? An encouraging word in a way. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're talking to John Beaver, president of Phase 3 Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm and registered principal with Royal Alliance Associates. John's been telling us that coming out of a midterm, the market almost always goes up. How many out of how many times? 20 out of 21, something like that, John?
Yeah, 21 out of 22 times 6 months after the midterms, the market is higher, and that's since 1934. It did not hold true in 1930, however. The deep decline of the stock market crash that year is one of the exceptions.
And you don't see any thing to change your mind about that. We're not. This isn't 1930, so you're optimistic. Do you think? Do you have a number? Do you see how much the markets are going to move up?
I don't think a lot more, so I'm not super optimistic. There are some negatives out there. So while we've got the positive with the midterms, and that's a short-term positive,
yeah.
I have to throw the Astros in there, that's positive too.
What is this with you and the Phillies? I thought you were going to defer to when a National League team wins or an American League team wins, but this sounds more like you're dialed in on the Phillies. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, really, it's nothing against the Phillies. I feel sorry for them. I really do. But unfortunately, when the Phillies win, the market does terrible.
I didn't know that. They haven't won the World Series that many times.
No, a couple of times. So
but they do bad. Okay, keep going.
Yeah. Okay, so earnings are a neutral for stocks, and you have to have increasing earnings. Ultimately, the stock market prices itself off of earnings. And so we take a look at the earnings of all the S&P 500 stocks together, and we use that as one of the indicators. So we need to have increasing earnings. You know, the market can overcome the headwinds of inflation and of interest rates as long as earnings remain strong. And the earnings this year, they're weak. They're not the best. And we're down from last year. That's understandable given the loss now of the government stimulus and some other things. But we've got positive numbers coming in, but they're not super positive. So I'd say the earnings are neutral on the market. So we got a chance of moving higher because of the midterms, a chance of moving maybe a little bit higher because of earnings. But then we got the recession on the front here, and that is the negative that's out there. You see, Americans have lost affordability. Inflation isn't a problem as long as you keep pace with inflation. The problem is when you don't keep pace with inflation. And so that's a negative. The consumer is weakening. And while the recession talk right now is taking a backseat to the election, and probably will for at least a week until we know that everything is resolved with the election, those recession fears are going to come back because Jay Powell made it very clear in Jackson Hole. They are going to continue to increase interest rates until they see inflation come down to 2% and they see the unemployment rate increase. So that's the bad news about the stock market and a possible recession.
But this recession strikes me as a slow train wreck that we all see coming, and we're all going to watch it in real time, and we're all going to be on it or near it, but that we know what it is. We know what it looks like. We almost know how long it's going to last. I mean, it strikes me as something that, however unfortunate for all of us, is manageable. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it is manageable, and the market is, I think, partly priced in a recession, but not too much. There's still a lot of soft landing talk out there that maybe we won't have the recession. It's really hard to tell. We cannot predict what's going to happen with this, and this makes the hard point. And this goes back to how you design your portfolio. You've got to be able to weather a recession in the next year, and if it does happen, I think it's going to happen next year. And you've got to be able to weather that. So you have to have money on the sidelines where you don't have to sell a stock at a loss or in a down market to pay your bills. So three-year money shouldn't be in the market. It just shouldn't be there. Even with this potential rally, go ahead and put some fun money in if you want to. But your serious money that you're going to need in the next couple of years should not go into the stock market because of this looming recession. And again, the Fed has said they're going to, in essence, create a recession to slow the economy so that
right.
they can take the pressure off of inflation. They've made that very clear. But maybe we've heard it so much that now we're just used to it, and when the recession actually happens, that'll be the trigger for a further sell-off. But the market doesn't sell off really far into the recession. The market tends to sell off before the recession and bottom the first month of the recession.
Well, the Fed only has so many tools. I mean, what do you like them to do in December? Do you want it at 50, 25, 75? What do you like?
Yeah, I want to see it at 50, and then I want to see them just, almost stop at that point in time and let the interest rate increases do the intended work and not go overboard. See, they went too overboard yeah. on stimulating. They put too much money in after the financial crisis, too much money in after COVID, and now they got to get that money back. Unfortunately, they're really not taking the money back. They're raising interest rates, which that's normalizing them, but they do also have to take back this $9 trillion that they printed and injected into the system. And they're starting to do that. There's something that's called the balance sheet runoff, where they let these bonds mature, And what they've done is, you know, they buy bonds. It gives the banking system and the financial system dollars, and they hold these bonds. As these bonds mature, hopefully they won't go in and buy more Treasury bonds. They'll just let those roll off.
1911 World Series, the Philadelphia Phillies beat the Giants. What happened that year?
Beats me.
Recession.
But I would guess the market was down.
Market was down. 1929, Philadelphia Athletics beat the Chicago Cubs 4-1. What happened in 1929 in the fall?
Yeah, that was not good. That was worst of all, 1929 into 1930.
1930, the Philadelphia Athletics beat the St. Louis Cardinals 4-2. Great Depression. 1980, World Series. Philadelphia Phillies beat the Royals 4-2. Double dip recession in 1980. 2008, Phillies beat the Rays 4-1 and ushered in the great financial crisis. I hate the Phillies.
Aren't you glad they lost?
Good to talk to you, John. Thanks for your thoughts.
You too.
That's a John Beaver. Thank you, producer Pete, financial advisor, Phase 3 Advisory Services. Philip Shoemaker joins us now on WGN Radio, executive director of Identity.com. By the way, Elon Musk had some ideas for everybody on how they should vote tonight. And Philip, you're a bit of an expert on Elon Musk for us, aren't you?
I wouldn't claim that, but I know a lot about what he's doing business-wise.
You're the executive director of Identity.com. What's Identity.com?
For us, we're focusing on a decentralized identity solution, which means you don't give away your full identity when you go to when you need to do anything online. Instead, you just give out the pieces that they need, keeping most of your privacy to yourself.
Does that mean I'd still have a username and password when I sign up for things?
Not necessarily. You can do something using what's called a decentralized identifier. It's just a little token that represents you. So there's nothing secure. There's no passwords you have to, there's nothing securely transmitted that has any sort of your data involved at all. No passwords, no usernames. It's very secure using encryption.
You were one of the creators of Apple's original App Store, right?
Yes, sir, I was. I built the team that did a lot of the moderation as well, which makes me kind of very interested in what Elon is doing with regards to content moderation on Twitter.
What do you mean by that?
Well, my team was the one that I built and wrote the guidelines with Steve Jobs to figure out what apps we allowed and disallowed in the store, and honestly, what those apps could do. For example, all the Instagram rules and Facebook rules and Twitter rules that are in the store with regards to nudity and pornography, things along those lines. So we're the ones that came up with those guidelines and decided what people were allowed to see and what they weren't allowed to see.
Kind of a subjective thing, huh?
Absolutely subjective. It's one of the things that I always said. Our guidelines for this were very subjective. It was very difficult to tell because it was all gray. Nothing was black or white. You know, the Supreme Court had a line about pornography, mm-hmm. saying they know it when they see it.
Well, so I wonder what Elon Musk will know and see, or what we will see based on what he thinks. It sounds like he wants to liberate, if you will, Twitter's platform more. What's your expectation?
You know, he's a businessman. He does not want it to turn into a cesspool that people are afraid of, right? The racism, the hate, all of that stuff that we're seeing on Twitter and have seen for many years on a variety of platforms is not something he wants to let permeate. Right? This is one of those things. He needs us to use the system. He wants to be able to make money. He didn't buy it for fun. It was a very costly purchase. He wants this to ultimately make money and knows he needs us to pay for those blue check marks, and he needs advertisers to be able to pay for those ads, which help it make money. So he's going to want to focus a lot on content moderation. And the good news is he can do that without hiring a lot of people. He can do that by writing machine learning algorithms, ones that will do all the heavy lifting and let reviewers just moderate more easily.
You don't think it was a mistake for him to let half the staff go?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, there were over 7,000 people at the company. I don't know what they did, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I think Elon's of the mind that, you know, you come in, you take a look, you have to burn it down, you burn it down and rebuild it from scratch. But hopefully he's not going to go that far, and he'll retain the staff that he thinks has the ability to do the hard work.
Do you think he should re-platform, welcome Donald Trump back to the platform?
I think ultimately, you know, I think it was very controversial what happened in the first place. He was a sitting president when he got deplatformed. Now, he violated a lot of the big rules on Twitter, and I'm shocked that it took as long as it did for them to deplatform him. I think Elon will come up with a strategy, make it a process, make some guidelines, and make them very transparent so the rest of us in the world will know two things. We'll know what you can and can't do, and we'll know what the punishment is if you do some of those naughty things. And I think once he gets that in line and his machine learning algorithms are crafted in a way to be able to catch those mistakes or those bad tweets, then he will probably onboard, let him back in, and maybe other folks, including Kanye.
Do you think that there's been a couple things that he's talked about doing. It sounds like he's set on $8 for a blue check mark, which you wouldn't have to have to use the platform. And he's also talked about a paywall, which you would have to get through to use the platform. What advice would you have for him on those things?
Look, to be honest, I think the $8 a month is just greedy, right? To me, that's not necessary. If you want to verify if I'm a real person, a blue check mark is not going to do that. All it's going to do is give me a blue check mark next to my name. It's not going to tell people that I'm not a robot, right? I'm not a bot that's going to spam you when you tweet. So to me, you got to onboard people using a solution such as identity.com's decentralized identity or one of our competitors. You need to use an identity solution to verify the humans from the bots. And then that's a one-time fee, right? It shouldn't be $8 a month. You have to pay for that service once. And once you're onboarded and you get a blue check mark, you stay that way. And to me, that's the main thing to do. The paywall is another story altogether. And I understand he wants to do that because Twitter's losing so much money right now.
Give me a short answer to bots. How hard is it for a platform like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter to notice if somebody is legitimate or not? A lot of times when those of us get something from a bot or click through to something that is bogus, it's instantly apparent. They have no followers or they're following nobody. There's no content there. How difficult is it for these massive platforms to ferret those out?
You know, it's not difficult at all. There's a variety of techniques you can use, including exactly what you said. Take a look at the profile. Take a look at how many tweets they've sent. Take a look how long they've been on the platform, et cetera. And they could easily whittle these down. The ones that are more complex are people that craft, and a lot of these heavy-duty bot companies do this. They craft an elaborate backstory. They have thousands of tweets. They've been on there for months, and now they're just using different ones. The good botsters, these guys that make these bots, they are smart, and they've been working on it for years, and they probably have a lot that they've created years ago that they're just sitting on waiting to deploy. And those are the tough ones to find out. And the only way you can do that is to start taking identity and using that to see if they're an actual human being or not.
Philip Shoemaker is the executive director of identity.com. I like the sound of what you're saying, a more streamlined, more minimalist way to participate in the digital sphere. And we need to talk about that next time in greater detail. Philip, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
He's the executive director of identity.com. Get you more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's landmark Blackstone Hotel is back up for sale. The owners of the Michigan Avenue Hotel have hired real estate services firm Jones Lang LaSalle to sell the property, according to Cranes. The 335-room hotel had been on the market a year or so ago without any takers because of the slump in travel demand. Blackstone is owned by New York Fundamental Advisors and Denver-based Sage Hospitality Group. The 22-story property overlooks Grant Park, and bids of between $55 million and $60 million are expected. Cannabis company Planet 13 has selected Waukegan over Chicago for its newest retail shop. The Las Vegas-based company had been considering several Chicago locations, including River North. Planet 13 CEO says Waukegan checked the boxes and is a location that's not oversaturated. He says the location also has the ability to drive some traffic down from Wisconsin. The 4,000-square-foot dispensary will be located in Waukegan's Fountain Square. An opening date has not been revealed, according to Cranes. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And now, the business of food and Steve Alexander.
And we're about to have a smackdown between coffee and tea. We're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Today's National Cappuccino Day, so what better time to debate the merits of coffee versus tea? The Washington Post featured a smackdown of the health benefits of the two, and Eating Lab columnist Anahad O'Connor joins me to do a review of the smackdown.
Hey.
Okay, round one. Fiber. Which one has more fiber?
Coffee actually wins this round because coffee is a decent source of fiber. You can get almost 2 grams of fiber per cup of coffee.
Round two. Mental focus, and we're talking caffeine here, I presume, which both coffee and a lot of teas have.
But there's been research suggesting that tea might be the better option because it'll help you focus on the work you need to get done. But won't disrupt your sleep.
Round three. Well, I didn't see this one coming. Which one of these promotes a healthy gut?
This one goes to coffee because there's been research showing that coffee seems to promote beneficial bacteria that make up our gut microbiome.
Round four, and I'm going to skip the bill because it's kind of annoying. Lowering the risk of heart disease.
So this one, I would say, is a draw because there's studies on both sides showing that when you regularly consume coffee or tea, it does seem to lower your risk of heart disease.
Round five, a lower cancer risk.
This one goes to coffee. There's been a lot of research showing that coffee drinking seems to lower your risk of certain types of cancer, in particular colorectal, prostate, liver, endometrial, oral, and breast cancers.
Round six, type 2 diabetes prevention goes to coffee. Round seven, stress reduction goes to tea. And the final round of the smackdown between tea and coffee, longevity.
Yes. Having between 3 and 5 cups a day of coffee seems to promote longevity and similar effect for tea drinkers as well. So when it comes to longevity, this one goes to both coffee and tea.
And the winner by decision, coffee. I'm surprised. I always feel healthier drinking tea.
Yeah.
Anahad O'Connor, the Eating Lab columnist for the Washington Post. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at creditcards.com. Where are credit card rates right now, Ted?
Very high, unfortunately. We did a recent study of store credit cards. We found the average there is 26.72%, which is a record. For general purpose cards, it's 22.66. Both of these are up considerably over the past year because credit card rates are tightly tied to what the Fed is doing. So in most cases, your credit card is already 3 or even 3.75 percentage points higher than it was at the start of the year.
So if I'm carrying a $1,000 balance on my credit card and I'm paying 27%, what does that mean to me? Does that mean I'll pay an extra $270 if I keep that balance for the year? Or is that multiplied per month? How does that work?
Yeah, it's all about how quickly you pay it off. But if you only make minimum payments, the typical formula there is just 1% of the balance plus interest. So minimum payments can keep you in debt for a long time. Like even $1,000, which is actually considerably less than the average credit card debt, which is over $5,000. But you know, even $1,000, if you're paying something like 27%, you're probably going to be in debt for about 4 years if you only make minimum payments, probably rack up about $700 in interest on top of that $1,000 of principal. Credit card rates are so high that you really need to make debt payoff a priority. My top tip would be to get a 0% balance transfer card. These allow you to move your high-cost debt over to a card with a 0% promo rate that lasts as long as 21 months.
But to be clear on that, just on the math, if you do have a $1,000 balance and you're paying 27%, say you don't add anything to it, say you didn't do anything with it, that would be an extra $270 at the end of the year or at the end of the month. How does that work? Do you know?
It would be at the end of the year, approximately, because you know these are annual percentage rates. The math gets a little bit funky because you know the minimum payment is 1% of the balance plus interest every month. But this can really add up.
Are there any demographics on this? Are younger people borrowing more? Are older people having trouble keeping their head above water?
Unfortunately, it's really a problem throughout the age and income spectrums. We've heard for years that young adults are skeptical of credit, and I think a lot of that has gone away, especially for millennials as they've gotten older. I mean, the oldest millennials are close to 40 now, and buying houses, having kids. I think this myth that young adults didn't want credit is largely debunked. Although, you know, Gen Z, they're using credit cards, but not as much as their older peers. They're especially congregating around things like buy now, pay later. But I do think ultimately just about everybody ends up with a credit card. It is about 80% of all U.S. adults. You tend to have more debt the higher your income is, but I think some of that's an access to credit thing. Mm-hmm. On a prevalence basis, you're actually more likely to have debt if you have lower income. But really, this is something that cuts across demographics. More than half of active credit card accounts carry debt from month to month, according to the American Bankers Association.
What's the balance that most people carry month to month?
The average, according to TransUnion, is $5,270. So if you have the minimum payment math on that one, it's about 16 years and about $6,800 in interest to pay that off. So it's a really long time. It's a hefty interest bill. That's where I think it's great to get that 0% balance transfer card, or maybe consider a low-rate personal loan. You can get something about 6% if you have good credit over 5 years or so. Or nonprofit credit counseling is another great option. You don't even need great credit for that, but a reputable agency like Money Management International could probably get you into a debt payoff plan along the lines of 6% over 4 or 5 years.
If you go to creditcards.com, you can read more about this, and they have the list of the lowest average APRs for retail cards in 2022, starting with the Amazon Secured Card, the Military Star Card, and the Costco Anywhere Visa by Citibank at 10, 14, and 18.25%. And those numbers are the low ones. It's good to talk to you, Ted. We'll send people to creditcards.com.
Thanks for having me.